It's the Femme Fatale podcast, and welcome to episode 17 of it. Like all 16 episodes before this edition and all the future Femme Fatale podcasts that shall be, I take your questions about how entertainment and celebrity culture really work. Now, no matter how I get your question, via Facebook, via email, via Twitter, no matter how dangerous and inflammatory those questions may be, I take them, I research them, and I tell you the truth. I am Leslie Gornstein, and I am unafraid, or just really bitter, whatever sounds more appealing to you and all your Reddit friends who really should be subscribing to my podcast right now. Vote me up or whatever the crap you people do. With me this week is Lawrence Yee. Say hello.
Hello, everybody.
Yee, yes, that Lawrence Yee, the one who dishes gossip by the backhoe full, right, over at 2Fab, a TMZ entity. Yes?
Yes.
Oh, by the way, yes, a royal baby has been born to us. Yes, Comic-Con just ended, and the Television Critics Association TV previews are about to begin. Yes, Emmy season is now officially upon us, but Lawrence is here with us nonetheless, and I thank you, Lawrence.
Thank you, Leslie.
Now, Lawrence is going to help us answer a reader question about Emmys, actually, later in the show, but until then, Lawrence is going to have to survive because, along with a super-duper giant robot-themed segment fueled by Pacific Rim, which is also coming up. Yes, we are going to have a cage match this episode. In fact, I think we ought to get it out of the way now. Because if Lawrence goes down in this cage match, I got to find a replacement to help out with the rest of the show. And I need time for that. So let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's get to the brand new cage match. Lawrence is new to the arena, and if you are too, you're in luck. You get to listen as I explain what my cage matches are. As I've said before, you cannot be a decent entertainment reporter in this town, unless you have bloodlust. I think that Lawrence's bloodlust may be limited to a severe craving for a crisp white wine and an aged prosciutto, and perhaps a Real Housewife on a platter. Mm-hmm. But that is a form of bloodlust nonetheless. Anyway, so because hacking away at people with a cleaver is still unfortunately illegal, I need to get my aggression out somehow. So I challenge my guests to bring me their best celebrity sighting from the past few weeks. And then I do the same. And then I pronounce myself the winner and pretend that I'm in Game of Thrones and I can order Sir Ilan Payne to chop my enemy's head off. So, you do watch that show, right? Oh, Lawrence.
I want to. I just don't have HBO. And I can't believe I'm admitting that.
That is not, and that's not what you say.
I have it. Have the discs in my bag. And I want to watch them, but, you know, when it's not Housewife season, that's what I watch.
If you're in this business, you need to have some better excuse. Like, I'm sorry, I'm over at Clooney's Pied-à-Terre. Right, okay? Right. Make something up.
There you go.
So, do you have a sighting to bring into the arena, Mr. Yee?
I do.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, so it's funny that you mentioned Pacific Rim, because I actually did the Pacific Rim red carpet a couple weeks ago. Okay. And all the stars were there. It was the world premiere, so we had Guillermo del Toro, who I horribly mispronounced as Guillermo a couple times.
To his face?
Well, you know, it was very loud, so I hope he didn't hear me.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, Charlie Hunnam, Orinco Kinkuchi, who I can pronounce better because, you know, that's an Asian name, and I'm Asian.
Aren't you Chinese-American?
Yes, I am, but, you know, it works.
Uh-huh.
Charlie Day, which is a very simple name. Uh-huh. Rob Kaczynski, who's the new True Blood hunk.
Right, and the angry vampire Warlow.
Yes, and some other people. So, out of that pool of gladiators, I picked Charlie Hunnam. He was charming.
He's the main bro, the broed out bro.
He's the broed out bro. He's he was on Sons of Anarchy. He still is on Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah.
He's kind of the epitome of dirty sexy.
Really?
Yeah. He just
looks so clean cut and
boring
to me.
In the movie he does. And but you know, in real life and in Sons of Anarchy, he's a little bit more rough. But what I really like about him is that he's actually British, and he I think he's been in Hollywood long enough that his accent is a little muddled. Uh-huh. Now,
so you like that?
I like that because I think it shows that you are willing to kind of lose a little bit of yourself when you go to Hollywood. I think everybody does. So he's who I bring. He has, you know, the physicality. He's kind of a new face on the scene, but he's been around long enough that he has a strong following. And you know what? He's just a cool guy. He was really funny.
Example.
A lot of these, I asked him, if you've watched the movie, I asked him, one of the themes is that you have to link with your fellow robot pilot. as you're piloting these giant machines. And yes. I asked him if you can link with anybody in the world, who would it be? If you could access their memories. And he was like,
Garrett Hedlund, because they're the same person. I'm sorry, what? Go ahead.
Well, no, they actually do look alike. And Garrett's another guy. Like,
have you ever seen them in the same room together? Exactly.
I haven't. But Charlie's a little more blonde. But with Charlie, he said, my girlfriend, so I could finally understand what's going on in her head, which I thought was a really funny answer. And he said it kind of matter-of-factly. And then he was like, oh, she's going to kill me. And I just thought that was really, really nice. And, you know, for a leading man in a big summer blockbuster to, you know, kind of be so comfortable and... And he talked to everybody on the red carpet. If you guys don't know the red carpet protocol, I'll make this very quickly. You know, a lot of the times these actors will just talk to the biggest outlets.
Right.
You know, they'll do the TV and then they'll just walk right by you. And you're like pleading with them, please, please, Charlie. This guy talked to everybody. Really nice, really kind, but just a really good guy. And I like those types of guys in Hollywood. And, you know, but he still has that kind of edge to him that I think will help me out in this cage match a little bit.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, I am bringing a legend.
Legend.
A longtime television syndication legend. Are you an Everybody Loves Raymond fan?
Yes. So, funny show.
Doris,
some people tell me that I sound like Brad Garrett sometimes.
Maybe. Doris Roberts.
Lovely woman.
She's now about 87 years old, mm-hmm. I believe she is. We went to a pizza restaurant right near the Arclight. It's a brand new pizza restaurant. Stella... something that just opened there, and it's decent pizza. It's like if you're an Angelino, you'll know that it's not mozza level pizza, mm-hmm. but it's not terribly, it's like the second tier below mozza, like right. as good as you can get without being mozza or pit fire pizza. It's right in, it's like the pit fire pizza level, yeah. I would say, of pizza. And I look over and I see this old woman who looks a lot like Doris Roberts, only more feeble.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that cannot be Doris Roberts. Doris Roberts is feisty, not feeble. It was Doris Roberts. Right. But she's still feisty. And this is how cage matches are won, right here.
Yeah.
I know what she told someone.
What did she say?
Apparently somebody asked her for a recommendation for a movie. And she said, whatever you do, don't go see Lone Ranger. Don't go see it. She said, if you're going to see something, go see The Way, Way Back. But don't go see Lone Ranger.
And what was her reasoning behind that?
She just said it was awful. She just said she really didn't like it. So, and that shows that she's still got some pip left in that viv. And she was there, by the way, and this is also how cage matches are won. I knew who she was there with. She was there with a female agent, mm-hmm. who may not have been her agent, but it was there. She was there nonetheless.
Well, it's been a couple of years since Everybody Loves Raymond went off the air. So I'd assume that she was a little bit older, but it sounds like she still has a wicked sense of humor.
She still obviously does, and she still obviously does have very strong opinions, although I don't know if Charlie Dunham Hedlund will win or not. So
Hunnam. I think it's either Hunnam or Hunnam.
That sounds like almost like Jewish. It's like Hunnam. I'm Jewish. I could say that. Right. Okay. So it's time for my producer to pick me as the winner. Do you pick me as the winner?
If Lawrence had gone with the entire cast and crew of Pacific Rim, he would have gotten it. But because he zeroed in on this one guy who I thought was kind of lame in the movie, I'm going to have to go with...
Doris Roberts.
Yeah.
Well, you know, she is older and feeble, as you said, so maybe she deserves the win.
If you had brought in Idris Elba, you would have killed it.
Yeah. That guy has swag. Can you say?
He's accent.
He's like the Black Bond. And,
yes.
You know, he is very, very suave. He has this physicality about him.
And he doesn't give up his accent for jack diggity shit.
He did not.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't give up that accent for anybody. If you had brought him into the arena, it would have blown up.
Now I know.
Okay? Now, let's get to the first reader question. Have you seen Pacific Rim? I have my own thoughts about it. I know we should be focusing on the fact that it's fairly original, meaning it's not based on an existing franchise, and that's real nice. Overall, I thought the movie was fine. It was fun. It was fine. It had the over-the-top acting, apparently on purpose, as an homage to 80s movies,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, fine, but it was so broed out.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to get like all Jezebel on this, you know, but we didn't even really clap eyes on a female character, even a background female character, not even really an extra until Act Two. Until then, we essentially see bros out there trying to survive. And for the record, this film is supposed to be in a future where the very fate of the planet is in danger, and it's all hands on deck. And bunches of people have been flown all the way up to Alaska to build a big wall to keep space monsters out. And there is not a single female welder out there, which for the record makes Flashdance, a movie from 1983, more modern than Pacific Rim, which features exactly two female robot operators, by the way, one of which looks like a dude. Am I being too Jezebel about this?
No, I don't think you are. In fact, I noted that it's a movie that would absolutely appeal to guys. And listen, they included shirtless Charlie Hunnam, who was, again, my cage match pick for shirtless, because they needed to draw in the women somehow. I mean, they're not going to be excited about...
You know how you draw in the women? Put fucking women in the picture and not through the lens of the man and his struggle and, oh, he meets Rinko Kikuchi. How about make it... You know what would have been ballsy? Make it her story.
It was her story,
no,
in a sense.
No, brother, it was not her story. It was Garrett Hedlund's story. It was not...
Charlie Hunnam.
Garrett Hedlund's story. And they've done it before. It was called Alien. Dudes like Alien, don't they?
Dudes love Alien.
Well, what's the problem? What are they scared of? Vagina? Anyway, okay, so a reader had a question about Pacific Rim 2. This reader seems to think that the movie ripped off another pre-existing giant robot franchise and got away with it. So, to help address this reader's question, I did two things. One, I commissioned a massive evolutionary tree detailing all of the giant robot franchises throughout history, all the major ones. And you could see that right now at www.thefamefatale.com. And also, I invited the perfect person to do an interview. Adi Tantamed is a giant robot expert and historian, really, and a contributor to the Bleeding Cool blog. I interviewed him earlier this week. Adi Tantamed, contributor at Bleeding Cool. Welcome to the Fame Fatale podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Tiro in Mexico has written to me via Twitter about Pacific Rim. Isn't it just an expensive copy of the old Evangelion anime series? How could they get away with it without mention of it? Seems to me that they changed enough stuff on the story in order not to pay a dime to the Evangelion creators. I imagine somebody like shaking a fist and typing at the same time when I read this question.
He's not the only one to go around saying it, and basically everyone who says it's a ripoff of Evangelion is completely wrong. It's not a ripoff at all.
You know, you actually went so far in a recent column as to call people who held Tiro's viewpoint to be idiots. Are they idiots, or do they just deserve to be shoved into the cockpit of a malfunctioning transformer and shot into space never to return?
Well, that's a really good idea. I mean, if they admit that they're wrong when there's so much evidence to prove that they're wrong, then that's fine. If they insist that they're right despite all the evidence, then they are complete idiots.
Now, okay. Now, because you are a person who knows about every giant robot on massive monster fight ever devised, I would like you to go ahead and take a deeper crack at this. So there's obviously a long history of giant robots. Do you want to go through some of them with us?
Sure.
All right.
Where do you want to start?
How about Gigantor.
Gigantor, Gigantor, Gigantor.
Okay, Gigantor is basically where the giant robot genre as we know it started. There were some giant robots before it. They were made by Hollywood. I think things like Tobol the Great, where they were like giant rampaging robots that destroy cities, and they were basically the giant robot version of monster movies. But it was the Japanese that actually created giant robots for kids and made them heroic. Gigantor, the original version, was called Tetsujin 28, which means Iron Man 28. And it was very much a series done for 10-year-old boys, essentially. You get a giant robot that's three stories high, created by a scientist, and he gives it to his son before he dies, and his son controls it with a remote control watch by giving it voice commands. And what's a kid going to do when he's given a giant robot? Fight crime and fight evil giant robots. That's pretty much the entire cartoon show.
And what year did this come out, just so we can tell Tiro how long this has been going on?
That was about 1956 or so. I want to tell people like Tiro that, you know, dude, history did not begin with your childhood. A lot of things happened and came along before you were born.
Well, yeah, like Mazinger Z.
Sonani sobieru Kurogane no shiro, super robot,
Majin. Now, Mazinger Z is how the giant robot piloted by human people really started taking off. That was around 1974, and that kicked off, that made the whole giant robot genre in Japan and basically the rest of the world as we know it, but it's huge in Japan. And the thing about the giant robot genre that's interesting is that it's really metaphorically a celebration of technology. It's the notion of Japan embracing technology, and the idea is that technology is good. When used by good people, it's going to make our life better, and it's going to save our lives. So you get something like Mazinga Z, where the hero gets into this little hovercraft, this little plane, which serves as the brain of the robot. He flies the plane that connects to the top of the head of the robot, and that's pretty much where Guillermo del Toro got the idea of the robots in Pacific Rim from, because you notice that the cockpit and the brain of the robot is in the head of the robot in Pacific Rim as well. That is where it all came from.
Is Mazinga Z?
Yes.
And what year did Mazinga Z debut?
Mazinga Z was around 1974. And because Mazinga Z got so incredibly popular, it just kicked off the whole giant robots piloted by teenagers, mostly, genre. And there were like dozens, if not hundreds, of giant robot franchises and series that have been launched in Japan ever since.
Do you want to go through some more of them? What are some of the other, what else would you tell my reader when it comes to hammering home your argument here?
Oh, well, first there was Mazinga Z, and then around the mid-70s, the next step in the giant robot genre, the evolution of the genre, was Getter Robo. And that was the first of the transforming giant robots, which is where you get humans who pilot these aircraft or tanks or undersea watercraft, except that they would come together, join together to form a big giant robot. And out of that, you got a whole bunch of other transforming robots, and they're all over Japan. And you get Raiden, you get Guy King, and a lot of others that's going to take all day to mention, and I can't even remember all of them. And then out of all that, that was where Transformers eventually came from. Because what happened was Mattel, the toy line here in America, liked the look of the likes of Mazinga Z and Raiden and Guy King and a couple of all of these giant robots. And they didn't take the storyline, but they licensed the looks of these giant robots as toys and turned them into a single toy line and called it the Shogun Warriors. And that was how a lot of kids in the West got exposed to these giant robots for the first time by the late 70s. And then it was the Shogun Warriors that actually inspired Hasbro to create the Transformers. That's where Transformers came from. You can actually see the evolution and the line leading all the way back to Mazinga Z from this. Then the next evolution of the giant robot genre came around 1979 with Mobile Suit Gundam. That was where the robots were just giant robots that you pilot to fight wars. And the change in the genre was that before with Mazinga Z, the interesting thing was since this was meant for kids, they were like superhero and crime fighting stories. So somehow they never had to explain how these like brilliant scientists could all on their own build a giant hangar with a giant $10 million robot without funding from anybody, and then give it to their son to basically fly and fight crime with. With Gundam, that's where it changed the whole genre, because Gundam is really a space opera war saga. It's, like I said, it's a little bit like the War and Peace of space opera, except that you get some of the pilots flying giant robots that fight each other, that have giant guns, that have giant swords, and again, that's also partly where Guillermo del Toro got the idea of their robots having missiles and swords built into them from.
But now, we probably should talk about Evangelion.
Oh, yeah.
Because Tiro wrote specifically about Evangelion. You had a really great sentence in a recent analysis about Evangelion. I'm just going to let you take... I'm not even going to read it. Go ahead and school us again.
Okay, well, this is actually a huge spoiler because the revelation doesn't come until later on in the Evangelion series, which is that the Evangelion robots, the Evas as they're called, are not actually robots. They're actually giant clones of the pilot's dead mothers mixed with angel DNA. And the mechanical bodies are actually casings that keep these things in control, because without the casings, they might just go crazy and go out of control and eat and kill everybody. And the only reasons these kids can pilot the EVAs is because they're actually the children of the the cockpits of the Evangelion EVAs. It's kind of like, it's actually kind of like the womb. They're like these capsules, and these kids are suspended in them with oxygenized liquid that's like amniotic fluid. And Evangelion is was as a series would not have been possible if Mazinga Z or Gundam had not come along before it, because the director Hideaki Anno was having a lot of existential and personal crises. And he's almost like Ingmar Bergman if Ingmar Bergman decided to make a giant robot series instead of making movies about angst, people having angst with the church.
So the irony here is that the Evangelion series, which many people may think is what Pacific Rim ripped off, they're not even robots.
They're not even robots, but then they're set up to look like robots because they're kind of like a postmodern dialogue with the rest of the giant robot genre. It's Hideaki Anno's dialogue where he's thinking about all the things that he loved as a kid, all the pop culture stuff, which includes giant robots and the military and giant robots and kids who pilot giant robots. And he takes it even further in Evangelion, where these kids are emotional and dysfunctional wrecks. They're only 14 years old. Piloting these giant robots actually makes them go crazy. It gives them nervous breakdowns. They become almost completely dysfunctional. And it's incredibly traumatic to them. And so you could say that Guillermo del Toro does kind of pick up on the idea that piloting a giant robot may be cool, but it's not always such a great thing, because it can damage you emotionally or mentally or damage your health.
You know, I think that the point, the final question I want to ask you, and the point I think the takeaway is that there's no way really to make a property about giant robots fighting massive monsters and make it feel fresh, but I don't think that's the point.
No, it's not the point. The whole point of Pacific Rim is it's a love letter to the two things that Guillermo del Toro loved, which is the Japanese giant robot genre and the giant monster genre. Because here's the thing. A lot of people may not have seen a lot of these TV series and cartoon shows, but quite a lot of them were sold into syndication all over the world, and that includes Europe and South America. I know that the likes of Mazinga Z and Get a Robo and some of these other shows were in fact dubbed into Spanish and shown on Mexican television during the 70s and 80s and possibly repeated during the 90s. So Guillermo del Toro grew up on this stuff as much as any Asian kid did.
I think that we pretty much took our giant robot foot and smashed it down on doubt.
Well, there's this little interesting takeaway with the giant robot genre. Since it's not actually very normal to mash up the giant robot genre with the giant monster genre in Japan, they usually keep them separate. But then there was this instance with Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. Back in 1974, the first Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla movie was made. And during the 70s, they turned Godzilla into the good guy, because Godzilla started out as a metaphor for the atom bomb, which was scary and deadly and devastated everything. But during the 70s, when Japan started having nuclear power, they started turning Godzilla into a good guy in his movies, where Godzilla represented good nuclear power instead of scary nuclear power, as the first Godzilla movie did. And so in the first Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla movie, you had evil aliens who may or may not represent the Americans, depending on your point of view and how Japanese you are. They decide that in order to invade Earth, they're going to build a mecha version of Godzilla, which is a robot version of Godzilla, to try to defeat Godzilla. And of course, Godzilla still wins. Now, in the 80s and 90s, Toho Studios brought back Godzilla, and they realized that what made Godzilla really work was for Godzilla to be the bad guy again, that Godzilla is this unstoppable force of atomic nature. And in the early 90s, they decided to make a new version of Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, except this time it's the Earth Defense Force trying to hold Godzilla at bay and protect humanity who build a giant Mechagodzilla. And what's interesting is that the pilot of Mechagodzilla in the 90s movies was a woman, and that might be something that Pacific Rim might have been informed by as well.
It sounds like you really like Pacific Rim.
oh, I enjoyed the movie. It's since as somebody who watched all these giant robot cartoons growing up, I just thought, oh, cool. Somebody actually put $200 million to actually create what it would actually feel like, because you never always quite got the sense of weight and the sense of scale of how big these things are. So as far as summer movies concerned, it's probably the best summer movie of this year, because it's the one that attempted to show all this stuff by somebody who's completely geeky about this and who wants to show you all as many of the implications of what would happen if you had this kind of thing as possible, and how cool it is as well as how scary it is.
Adi Tantamed, thank you so much. I feel so schooled.
You're welcome.
Gigantor the Space Age Robot is at your command. Gigantor the Space Age Robot, his power is in your hand.
And we're back. Lawrence, perk up. It's time to shine. Read the next question.
Joshua Baldwin asks via Facebook, why is American Horror Story listed by the Emmys people in the miniseries category? Wasn't it a drama at last year's Emmys? Thanks.
Okay, I do have an answer for this, but I want to hear from Lawrence first.
Absolutely. Okay. So American Horror Story Asylum and the last year's American Horror Story, that was actually nominated as a miniseries as well. There's a lot of different ways how they do these categories. Sometimes they do it advantageously for the actors and actresses and the producers, because they don't want to go up against a strong perennial like a Mad Men or a Breaking Bad.
The producers of that show.
Correct.
Don't want to go against those other people.
When you're in a very strong category that you have no hope of winning against, you know, it's kind of a futile exercise. So why not be a standout in a weaker category where you know you're going to pick up a lot of, you know, you can potentially pick up a lot of wins and call yourself an Emmy-winning series. Listen, an Emmy-winning series is always better than an Emmy-nominated series in anybody's book, right?
Right.
So this is the story with American Horror Story. I also think that because the show is not your traditional drama, you know, it is episodic, but each season is a completely different story. It's not like you're dealing with the same characters. Interestingly, Ryan Murphy loves to use the same actors, but they're different characters every season. So the characters that, you know, Evan Peters and Jessica Lange play in, you know, American Horror Story Asylum are not who they played in American Horror Story. It's a completely different plot. So it's not like you can consider it necessarily a drama in that respect as well, in the traditional sense of a serialized drama season after season.
From what I understand with the Emmys, and if you know anything about this, correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan Murphy lobbied the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences to be put in that category.
In the miniseries category.
In the miniseries category. That's according to Deadline Hollywood, so I don't know if that's true or not. If that's the case, he probably had to make an argument with the very reasons you're giving. And then, you know, the Emmy people were like, okay, we don't want to piss off Ryan Murphy because I'll have to hear it forever. So, right. You know, that's what they did.
Listen, everybody wants to be a winner, right? So why not put yourself, be the big fish in the small pond, I guess is the best way to.
Oh, totally. I mean, like, Breaking Bad is the best show on television, period, end of discussion.
Right.
And you're not going to win. Your acting is not going to win against Bryan Cranston. No one wins against the Cranston.
Right.
Ever. Right?
Yeah.
So I can see why they would want to do it. What I'm intrigued by is why Emmy let them do it. I'm guessing because it makes, and also if you're the Emmy people, it makes your category more exciting.
Absolutely. Even though I think it's a shoe-in for Jessica Lange. I really do.
Yes. Final question of the week, Lawrence. Are we ready for it?
Yes.
Go.
Amanda P. asks a royal baby question via Twitter.
What?
We now know that the new baby is a boy, but if it were a girl, she would be the first to benefit from Britain's new succession law, allowing females equal standing in the royal line. Could the female succession law change have been a wedding present from the Queen to Kate? Is it likely that Kate asked for it?
I know why the question was so hard for you, and it's because you've had 12 seconds of sleep because of that damn royal baby, right?
Right. I apologize. Yes, I stayed up until 4 a.m. waiting for this baby to make its appearance in the world, and it didn't make its appearance until about 12:30 Eastern time. I'm so glad that I'm horribly sleep deprived, but you know what? It's here. I think we should all celebrate. Let me just say that I'm actually a big Royals fan, and I've always been. So I'm really happy. I just find them fascinating. I found Princess Diana to be this magical, beautiful woman, and all the drama and the scandal that involved, you know, Fergie and Diana and, you know, that entire family. I think this new generation, this Prince William, Prince, you know, the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate, I think they're just actually likable people. And it's nice to see that the royal monarchy, can still be respected and not be this scandal kind of feel thing. I mean, let's not talk about Prince Harry and his trip to Vegas, because that was an embarrassment. But, you know, they seem like nice,
every family needs a likeable, crazy ginge.
Yes, a crazy ginge. But it's also, they also like to have a stabilizing force. So, sorry, that's my two cents on the
royal family. It's interesting that you say that, because I have my own opinions about Kate. Hey, sound editor, do we have time for me to like rant about Kate for like 30 seconds or, okay, 2 minutes? Okay. This is my deal with Kate Middleton. Mm-hmm. I don't like Kate Middleton. I don't hate Kate Middleton. What? I just think we don't know jack shit about Kate Middleton. This is what she does. Mm-hmm. She gets up in the morning, and Princess Diana collapsed like within the bright light of the little square that she was put in. Okay. Right. Fergie colored outside the lines.
Right.
The thing about Kate Middleton is she is perfectly appropriate. She colors inside the lines. Exactly. She doesn't go outside of them. She doesn't collapse within them. She is appropriate in all things. She dresses beautifully. Mm-hmm. She watches her weight. She shuts the fuck up. She goes to places. She delivers a baby. She smiles, rinse, repeat. She almost never does interviews. She never says anything in public. Right. I think she's given 2 speeches or something. I love it. I find it very interesting when people say that she's a likable person or not a likable person, because to me, she is about as developed a character as Bella Swan was in Twilight. She's a Mary Sue. She's a completely blank slate. We don't know anything. We don't know anything about her. We can make her whatever we want her to be.
And I think that's the point here, is that, you know, you can only imagine the level of scrutiny Diana and Fergie were under. That was before Twitter.
Yeah.
That was before internet. That was before the level of paparazzi that they can intrude in your privacy nowadays. You know, they can hack into your emails. They can do anything like that. If I were Kate Middleton, I would be intentionally guarded, you know, and she's relatively new to the scene. So of course she wants to put out a great image. And you know what? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with being the sweet girl, the princess that everybody wants? Listen, I don't think she's some crazy partier. Her sister, her brother, probably. But you know, what's wrong with being a nice girl who married a nice prince?
There's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong with it is when people start assigning things to her, calling her a fashion icon, calling her likable, calling her anything. You can't call her anything because we don't know anything.
Fair enough.
I'm saying. And when people say she's a fashion icon, yes, you mean she puts the clothes on and they do not fall off of her? Yes, that's correct. She dresses very appropriately. She dresses beautifully. But she's not Schiaparelli. She's not revolutionizing shit. Right. She just goes out and looks good and wears British designers, and that's her job. She's doing her job beautifully. But when people start saying things like, oh my God, she's one of the most remarkable women living today, I'm like, prove it. Tell me something you know that I don't know.
She's only been in the spotlight for 2 years.
Exactly.
Let's give her some time. Let's see how she is as a mother.
It's not a criticism of her.
Let's see how she is as a wife.
It's not a criticism of her.
Let's see how she is as a public figure.
It's a criticism of these people who are like, she's an icon. You don't know shit. You don't know. No, people don't know anything about her, so stop assigning things to her. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's fine. She's a fine figurehead. She's doing a beautiful job. But let's not get crazy.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. That's
all. I hear your point.
It's not about her. It's about everybody else. Just calm the fuck down.
Right.
Now.
So back to the question.
Back to the question. Now, okay, could the female secession law change have been a wedding present from the Queen to Kate? No. Short answer, no. First of all, the Queen does not have the authority to make such changes in the law anymore. Such policies have to come to Parliament via the Prime Minister. That's according to the University of Texas at Arlington British history professor Elizabeth Cowthon, who was so kind as to walk me through this. That's the first thing you need to know. Second thing you need to know comes from a British Royals watcher with the fabulous name of Adora Olin.
That's a name.
The only thing she should ever be doing is royal watching in a British accent and calling me.
She probably was a fascinator while she watches.
Born with a fascinator.
Yeah.
So I got her on the blower today, and according to what she knows about the pecking order over there at Buckingham Palace, Kate really isn't in the position to ask for anything. And here's a quote from Adora. I don't think Kate would be in the position to ask for any tradition changes. But that said, she says Prince William perhaps would have brought it up. But both my sources say that more likely this has been in the works for a long time, and that the royal family very likely has been working with Parliament to bring itself into the modern era, to do things in a more modern way. And this is one sign of that. So that just about wraps things up for me this week. Lawrence,
yes.
If the children have a question for me, how do they reach me?
Well, they can write to you at leslie@thefamefatale.com. or ask you a question in the comments section of your blog at www.thefamefatale.com. If they prefer Twitter, they can holler at you at Bane Patel Says, or find you on Facebook.
Now tell me all about what people need to know about 2FAB if they want to see your work.
Well, they can go to www.2FAB, that's TOOFAB.com. You can also find us on the homepage of TMZ. We do all the fun stories on TMZ, that's what I always say.
Yeah.
And they can also follow us at 2FAB on Twitter.
And is that you typing on the 2FAB?
You know, I have a group of people. You can also follow me at Lawrye, which is L-A-W-R-Y-E-E on
right.
Twitter. But, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, why don't you tweet so much to your personal account? Because I'm tweeting all day at 2FAB. So that's where you should see the best stuff.
And I think that, like, it's probably just like, where's the damn baby?
Yeah.
Where's the damn baby? 3 p.m. Where's the damn baby? 3:01.
Exactly.
Where's the damn baby?
Exactly.
Lawrence, given how little sleep you've gotten, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. I've had a great time.
And we will see you next week.